How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast with Nadine O'Regan.
Sponsored by Glamdoor, creating space for business to grow.
Hello, hello, and welcome to How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast with myself, Nadine O'Regan, and sponsored by Glamdoor. This is the podcast series where we talk about leadership through interviews with female leaders and advice from experts who can help you move forward. A little bit later on in the second episode, I'll be joined by Susan Keogh, communications consultant with Cicero and an award-winning broadcaster, who will be dispensing some very valuable advice on public speaking. But to our first guests now, I'm delighted to tell you that on this episode of How I Did It, coming to you from our studio space in Dublin 2 at the offices of our sponsored Glamdoor, I'll be joined by two women who have forged exceptional careers in politics in Ireland and beyond, Frances Fitzgerald and Joan Burton. A former Taoiseach, Frances Fitzgerald has been an MEP for Dublin since 2019 and Vice President of the EPP Group in the European Parliament since 2021. Raised in Stillorgan, she attended UCD and the London School of Economics. She has a Master's in Social Administration and Social Work, and prior to her engagement with politics, she worked with disadvantaged communities. A Fine Gael parliamentarian for over 20 years, she was previously Minister for Business, Enterprise and Innovation, Minister for Justice and Equality, and Minister for Children and Youth Affairs. Former Taoiseach Joan Burton was Minister for Social Protection from 2011 to 2016, and a TD for Dublin West for over two decades. A former leader of the Labour Party, Burton has spoken in the past about the many issues that have faced vulnerable communities in Ireland. Adopted herself as a baby, she grew up in Stony Batter in Dublin, and has spoken of how she didn't receive her long-form birth certificate until she was nearly 50. She was elected to the Dáil for the first time in 1992. In the podcast you're about to hear, Joan and Frances speak about how they got into politics, the personal moments that they have found most difficult to bear, their thoughts on some of their peers, and the help they did or did not receive, and also, of course, about the war in Ukraine. Both Joan and Frances have had truly remarkable careers, and even talking to them for an hour, it's easy to see firsthand the drive and determination that has helped shape their path. So, without further ado, here is Frances Fitzgerald's and Joan Burton's How I Did It.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
Joan and Frances, you are very welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Really well, considering that I think the pandemic and COVID has been difficult for everyone. But now that we're free again, I certainly feel so much better.
Yes, I'm the same. In good form, enjoying my new role in Brussels and as MEP for Dublin City and County. It's actually this week, it was a very sad week with Ukraine being on the agenda. And a very unified approach in Brussels. Great solidarity, I have to say. But people are just, they can't believe what's happened. Nadine, obviously, it's really just so tough on the people in Ukraine. And we're doing everything we can, but it probably isn't going to be enough to save the country. This is changing the world. There's no doubt about that. It's changing Europe. It's changing attitudes to defence and security. It's making people think about ordinary citizens are saying, why don't you go in? And then, of course, you say, actually, if you sent in a military force, this is World War III. This could be nuclear, given that we're dealing with a man like Putin. So it's an incredibly complex situation. And yes, I think looking on, like most people, you feel a whole array of feelings, from hopelessness to, you know, delight at the solidarity we're seeing, the fact that it's Joe Biden is in America and not Donald Trump. That America is united with the EU in what we are doing in relation to sanctions. So, yes, change is definitely in the air, not for the better. We didn't think we'd get back to a war, an old-fashioned war, if you like, seeing buildings being blown up. But, of course, there's conflict all over the world. It's just that this is very close to us, so Europeans are reacting in a different way and opening their borders in a way that they haven't before, quite honestly, to maybe up to 7 million refugees.
It's unbelievable the damage that's done to totally innocent people in any kind of war scenario. Ireland has an enormous role in trying to promote and using our UN seat to promote some kind of truce and hopefully then peacekeeping and allowing civilians to return. But that could be very long way down the road. It could be 2 or 3 years. I also know as well, because, you know, the part of Dublin I represented has huge populations of people from the Baltic states and from Moldova. And I would say people in those countries are terrified that Putin is going to roll tanks just down the road in a couple of hours at some stage. And so they're under threat as well. So I think, you know, these are the most difficult events for Europe, certainly since the Bosnian conflict. But this conflict is much bigger than the Bosnian conflict. I've always operated politically in the Dublin 15 area and Francis on the far side of the river. And of course, we welcomed the first couple of hundred of Bosnian families in the early 90s, and the whole Irish community reached out to them. And I'm delighted now to know people who are PhDs, doctors, busmen, drivers, a whole variety. And they were the children of the Bosnians who either came to Ireland with their parents or were born in Ireland.
It's difficult to move on easily from this topic. It's what we're all thinking about. But I do want to discuss your early lives and careers. Joan, were you always political?
I was always interested in politics. I'm not sure I would have called it politics then, but I was just always interested in current affairs and history and stories. I grew up with that. And I suppose the first thing that I joined in the sense of an NGO-type organisation was the Irish Anti-Apartheid Movement back in the 1970s. And I became Honorary Secretary of that. So in that context, I was just awfully interested in Africa and seeing the end of apartheid. I certainly didn't think in terms of anything like a political career. I got involved in the Irish Labour Party. And the reason I chose the Labour Party was because for somebody of my background, where I had lived for a couple of years as a baby in institutions, and from that I went to live in Africa, in East Africa, for 3 years, and I worked there as a lecturer in the university in Dar es Salaam. And that, by the way, was a period when there was a lot of difficulty in different parts of Africa. So I just became very interested in international affairs and was incredibly happy after I'd come home from Africa and Nelson Mandela finally got released from jail. I suppose ultimately Dick Spring asked me to become more involved in the Labour Party.
Francis, you studied in both Dublin and London, and you were a social worker in a variety of disadvantaged settings. You obviously have great empathy for people who are suffering. Were you always conscious of women's rights and of the need to agitate for women's rights?
You know, I wasn't really. It was something that I became aware of and began to understand more, actually, in my 20s, really, and in my 30s, when my children were born. My eldest son was born in London, and I got involved with an organisation there called the National Childbirth Trust, which was about supporting women who were pregnant. I didn't know that many people there. I had friends, of course, because I was working as a social worker there. And then I began to look at the kind of women's voices, you know, women having a voice in maternity care and support after birth and those kind of areas, which, ironically, over the last 20 years have become such an important focus, you know, about how our maternity services operate, how women are listened to or not listened to, all of those issues. So I didn't wake up at 15 and decide I wanted to be a minister or a politician, unlike some people we know very well. I know I always make that joke about Leo and people take it very seriously. But actually, I mean, I never thought about going into politics. I was out at a school this morning in Dublin, and I spoke to them, and I said, they were asking lots of questions about Ukraine, about everything, climate change. And I said to them, you know, I wouldn't have been able to ask a question at 17 in my class. I was very shy. I was a little the same in college. I loved university. I loved UCD, did social science. Really what drove me was my social work and social science. I adored my social work. I worked in hospitals, I worked in community settings, I worked with young people in London who were missing school, not attending school, had sort of delinquency records, and I worked as a child and family therapist. So, and I was very interested in social issues, and I always had an interest in inequality. I think my parents, who came from a small town, Charleville in County Cork, I think they had seen, if you like, what we'd now call maybe, you know, a class, a society very much based on class. And, you know, I always grew up from them with this sense of it was so important to give people opportunity. Because my parents got an opportunity. My dad got an opportunity to go into the army from a working class family and, you know, managed through education to move on and then gave all of his children that opportunity. And so I just had this deep sense that I hated sort of class divisions. I hated inequality because I knew how much it limited people. And my social work was what kind of drove me. And then my interest in feminism and women's rights. And then throughout my 20s and particularly 30s, I got more and more informed about, if you like, women's rights. We used to bring over a lot of American politicians. I just by chance got involved in the Women's Political Association. My family weren't political. I never thought about being a politician, never, ever. I got involved in equality. Then I became chair of the Women's Council. And of course, we were working on all of the issues that we still talk about today. We were working on LGBTQI rights. We were working on women in sport, women in the media. We were working on childcare discrimination in the law. And I was on the second commission on the status of women that, ironically, Charlie Haughey set up. And much of that has now been dealt with. But in fact, there's a whole lot of new issues. So, no, I did not ever set out. And I would always say to people, you know, think about politics at different stages of your life. I was 42. When I was elected, you see a lot of young women being elected now. But it's nice to bring you both your personal experience of having children, for example, in my case, and also your experience of your career. I worked sort of full time, part time, half time, took paid leave, you know, all sorts of leave when I was combining my work and family life. So that kind of, you know, influenced what I did as a politician and indeed as a minister.
You chaired the Council for the Status of Women, which is now the National Women's Council, between 1988 and 1992. To what extent do you feel the challenges facing women have changed since then?
Well, I think what's different now is that there's greater shared understanding about equality and diversity and how very important it is. I think what hasn't changed is that some of the issues haven't still been dealt with fully enough. And I could go through them all. Women in decision-making in Ireland is a disgrace. In terms of the parliament, in terms of senior levels in business, we just don't have enough women, despite the fantastic progress women have made in education, experience and so on. Childcare, and Joan and I both worked on this in Cabinet, childcare is still not as available as it needs to be. And you can only conclude that there aren't enough people making decisions, both in Ireland and internationally, in relation to childcare, or there are countries that do it much better than us, that it doesn't impact enough on personally to know that it's a core issue. I've now got the European Commission to agree to do a care strategy next year, and that'll be about elder care and childcare as well. So that issue remains much the same. And unfortunately, violence against women, which we were dealing with then, is still, and if anything, it's probably a greater issue. And I had a very interesting conversation just this week with the Prime Minister of Iceland, who said to me that in Iceland, as equality has grown, and it's a very equal society, they have greater numbers of women coming forward to report gender-based violence. And she thinks the reason is that it's coming out into the open, that people were hiding it before. And it's a very interesting remark that she made about it. So that continues to be a really big issue. And, you know, everyday sexism is still very common. And there's different issues like pornography, always there, but now, you know, really just such an issue around the world. And, of course, online abuse. So there are new issues. It's unfinished business. And I've got to the point where I just say, as I'm sure Joan has, well, you just keep working on it.
Joan, you've spoken about being one of a very small number of female commerce students in UCD and getting wolf whistled one day when you arrived late to a lecture hall. What was it like being a 20-something woman in Dublin in those days and experiencing a form of harassment, while not intimidating, was certainly very much having the effect of drawing attention to gender and to sexuality?
Well, the reason I turned up late was that in those days, scholarships for girls came after scholarships for boys. So, in fact, I was working at the time in the GPO, and I got the scholarship to UCD based on my leaving, and I went to a school called Stanhope Street. So I was one of the first people from the school to go to college, and also from the area where I lived, which is Stony Batter, which is now, as you know, very, very fashionable. It was just a very strong working class community then. I mean, I remember I arrived out in UCD and I met a very famous porter called Mr. Keogh. And Mr. Keogh said to me, he had this cubbyhole going into UCD with a big fire. And he said, like, who are you? What are you here for? And I said, I've just got confirmation of a scholarship and I had the papers in my hand. And he said, come in here and sit down. And he sat me down beside the roaring fire and he said, now, what is it you want to study? And I said, English and history. And he said, now, hold on. And we went into backgrounds and where he was from and where I was from. And he said, look, you're actually going to need a job. And he said, I'm going to recommend do English if you want to, do history if you want to, but do commerce as well. So actually, I signed up for both. And I suppose I was arriving a week or 10 days late. And he just sent me down the road to, say, the door down there to the class was on. And commerce had about 200 students at the time, very small number of women, large numbers of young guys. And I opened the door at the bottom of the lecture theatre because that's where he showed me into. And the room erupted. And there was a woman lecturer, one of the O'Keeves, lecturing, you know, in integration and various elements of mathematics. So I'd say it was the most enjoyable break that had happened. So just all hell broke loose for about 10 minutes. And, you know, the hall was won from floor to ceiling, you know, decked rose. Anyway, I found a spot, sat in it, and actually, I didn't care, you know, but it was, let's say, probably intimidating. And I've always felt if I could withstand that, I could withstand anything else, you know. So very easy to call out, you know, people in the Doyle if they were belittling you, if you wanted to get involved in that kind of thing. But anyway, some of my best friends I made there, and they're my friends to this day.
Well, you mentioned the Dáil. You were first elected to the Dáil in 1992. What made you want to run in the first place?
I suppose when I was living in Africa, and, you know, one of the funny things about living in a country like Tanzania, it's quite a conservative African country, equally split, say, between Christians and Muslims, was that they had divorce. And before I left Ireland, the first divorce referendum had failed. So when we were coming back to Ireland, it was one of those things where the divorce referendum was still very much in my mind. And I was going, what's about this African country that it actually has these facilities in terms of women and men? So that just, I suppose, triggered my interest all over again in politics. The school I attended in Stanhope Street, the person who kind of worked with the school was Sister Stanislaus Kennedy. And she, like a lot of nuns, had no room for anything like anybody feeling sorry for themselves, because there was always somebody who was worse off. And she shared a lot of, you know, the kind of her general approach to social change in Ireland. So I just was always interested in politics. I didn't particularly ever see myself as a candidate. And in fact, my husband was more involved in politics at the time when we got married, in the sense that he got elected twice to Dublin City Council. And then he decided he was just going to give it up. And we went away, lived in Africa. And then when I came back, actually, it was probably related to Mary Robinson in a way. She ran to be president in 1990. I knew her, Pat knew her very well. And we worked on her campaign. And Dick Spring, as I say, approached me about running. And it just built up from that.
Were you ambitious? Were there inspirations along the way?
Yes, I think I'm always ambitious, as it were, to be the best for myself and for other people. So I've always encouraged people, particularly around education, because I just think education is the key to all opportunity.
Frances, I'll put the same question to you. Were you ambitious?
No, I wouldn't describe myself as ambitious in the early years. I was kind of more interested in, I was very interested in all the talk around, you know, equal rights. I was interested in what's happening in the world. I was watching what some of the women here were doing, you know, people like Monica Barnes, I thought was amazing. Now, all this was in my 30s when I got involved in the National Women's Council. And we were going in lobbying ministers, you know, we were going in meeting the Minister for Agriculture, talking about the issues affecting rural women. We were going in, I remember one day going into Charlie McCreevy. He was then Minister for Social Welfare. He was watching Cheltenham when we went in, and he said to us, sit down there, girls. And I mean, nobody would do it now, but just think of the image, like, and he was so friendly and such a lovely person to meet, you know. Sit down there, girls. And we kind of looked at him and
Charlie
thought.
Charlie was in my class in college. Years later, we met in Leinster House, and he said, in typical Charlie fashion, JC, what happened to you, Joan? I don't understand. What did they do to you in that Labour Party? For God's sake, we used to go to the races and everything.
He always had an interest in racing. So then another time, some of the members of the Women's Council went in to see a Minister for Justice, and they were discussing about rape and violence. And they said to him, and we want to include in the legislation if somebody's raped within marriage. And he said, ah, now, girls, you know, come on. You know, this was outside the, and this is going back. So you can see about the attitudes, and, you know, and the Women's Council was always sort of pushing things out. I introduced the concept of equality proofing, for example, and we started really trying to push that. And then we did the first conference on women in decision making. And I remember Maura Gagan Quinn was involved in it as well. We had it in Dublin Castle, and we pushed that as the Women's Council. But that was the first time in the 90s that that was raised as an issue. So I was, you know, as the chair of the council, and I had a great team working with me. We were, and it was voluntary on my part, you know, this was, I wasn't the executive, there was an executive as well. And so we did a lot of media, and we were always pushing the boat out. And I remember going into Leinster House, I think for the first time, with Nuala Fennell, I think, and looking down and seeing all these men in there, and I thought, this is unbelievable. I was literally shocked. So then that image stayed with me. I thought, this has to change. And what happened then is that I was approached. I was doing a lot of media at the time as chairwoman, and I was approached by a number of political parties. My Fine Gael was the party that I felt, you know, most sort of engaged with, interested in, and committed to. Gard Fitzgerald approached me and asked me would I run then in 92. And then I ran, had a very easy election. 3 weeks I was elected, thrown into politics. Did I know what was going on or how you were a politician? No, I had to learn it. And you learned a lot in politics, you know. Experience is a great thing in politics. You have to build up experience and understanding of how the system works. I think people whose own family are in politics probably in a way have an easier time because they get the way it operates. It's quite, you know, it's quite a lot to take on when you've never been in it. Even though I was involved in public life and I was an NGO and I was raising issues, it's quite different once you go into the system. And I went in 92 as well. It was, I think we went from 12 women to 20, was it, Joan? And that was seen as a big breakthrough. Now, it's still 25. It's still only 22%. You know, it's completely ridiculous.
Is more expected of women in leadership roles? Is there a different set of standards?
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure more is expected. I mean, I think the journey is more difficult, really. I think by the time you get to a leadership position, you generally speaking have a fair bit of experience and knowledge, and you can hold yourself fairly well. The journey in politics is very difficult, full of ups and downs. It's fairly vicious at times. It's totally exciting and wonderful to be elected by the public. I never cease to be amazed at that support you get. I mean, I remember the first time I was elected going into the Dáil, and I just had this, and I see it in the younger women now, I had this sense, I remember standing outside the Dáil and saying, this is fantastic, you know, and sort of, and I get paid as well. I mean, you know, it was a job, but that was my, you know, I loved the issues that I was dealing with, and I was very committed to them, and I still am. And so I'm not so sure there's a different standard. I mean, politics is rough on women and men. And we've seen that in recent days again, you know. So, but I think leadership is really important. I like the way women lead. I don't like the adversarial nature of the Dáil. I think there's different ways to do politics, actually, around the world. We don't have to follow Westminster and their extremely adversarial style. I've been in the Swedish Parliament. I've seen them do things very differently. So, I mean, being a woman, it was a fairly sexist place when we went in, fairly patriarchal. hierarchical in that sense, and you had to learn to deal with it. You know, everyday sexism was fairly common.
Have you made many personal sacrifices?
Well, I would say probably my family's made more, because I think most politicians' families give them tremendous support, and I know mine have, and I don't think without that I'd be able to do it. And also my friends have been unbelievably understanding of me and have, you know, tolerated all sorts of stuff, you know, when suddenly I can't be there, I can't be there. I remember one night going out to a really good friend of mine, and there were some other people at dinner with us, and it was kind of a long evening. And I remember I literally fell asleep, and I was so embarrassed because I was just exhausted.
What about abuse online? Frances, have you personally felt that there have been times when the sacrifice has felt too great?
Well, when I resigned, I did seriously wonder, could I encourage women to go into politics? That's the only time that I doubted, you know, that issue, because it was so tough. And I did, for a couple of months, I really kind of thought to myself, the injustice of this, I just, how could I encourage any woman to go into politics after the experience I had? And I've never been a victim in public and never intend to be, but I did seriously question it. Now, I worked my way around it back to saying, we've got to be in there, actually. So it's very tough. You ask about, you know, sexist abuse. Yes, there is abuse online, no question. There's a lot of fake news, misinformation, you know, about the approach you've taken on different topics. I think all of us have been subjected to that. To this day, there's stuff online that just isn't true. What do you do? I mean, you can't do anything about it, generally speaking. And I've, you know, like most people, I've had on Garda Síochána approach me to discuss different topics and different issues that have come up in regard to safety over particular incidents. So, you know, yes, that is part of it. And I think younger women probably are suffering a lot from that. But just to go back to a question you asked me earlier about being a woman in politics, one of the things you have to remember is that you're always a minority. You're a minority. And once you're a minority, there are extra challenges. So, for example, the networking amongst men, you know, and I often noticed it's much stronger. And I often noticed if, you know, there was a vacancy coming up and there was the automatic assumption is very often that a man will replace the person in ministry. Very often. It's a deeply held unconscious thing that's there over the years. Now, this greater awareness of the need to get a critical mass of women. But, you know, I remember one dear friend of mine, Teresa Hearn, saying to me at one stage, and she was on the front bench, and it was like, she said, why do they think that I have to be replaced and another woman come in instead of me? Why not add another woman and, you know, take out another man just to have more women in your front bench or whatever? And it was very heartfelt when she said it to me, because that was often the experience. There was kind of a thought, if you had one woman or two women, it's enough. I mean, when Joan and I were in cabinet, there were two women in cabinet. Now, I've seen three and four women in cabinet, but never more. It does make a difference, because the more women you have in the room, the greater the influence, the better the balance in decision making. We were two out of 15, and an AG who was a female as well, who was a fantastic AG, I would say, Maura Whelan.
And when I was in discussion with Enda Kenny about becoming Tánaiste, one of the things I insisted on was that there would be more women. And in fairness to Andy, he appointed Minister Humphreys, who's a minister to this day. And subsequently then, when it came to the appointments I made, Jan O'Sullivan joined the cabinet as well. And it is really important, both for men and women in government, that actually women are there pretty much in equal numbers. So I am an absolute believer that we should look to Scandinavia and other countries and say, we won't have a cabinet unless we have 50-50 of men and women, because you just have different life experiences. For instance, childcare. Most women do most of the childcare. They do an awful lot of the elder care. So it's very difficult to have a discussion. But one of the things that does happen is when you have more men and more women, actually it's okay to mention children, whereas normally they wouldn't really be discussed necessarily, right, except in a formal sense at a cabinet, or to say, God, I had a bad night last night. The baby's awake all night. you know, these kind of normal things in a normal job that people come in and tell you. And that's missing in politics. No woman has ever stood up in the door and say, I feel wrecked this morning because, you know, I have a young baby and the baby is crying all night.
Or no man.
It just doesn't. Well, no man. But the men with women around feel more empowered to say, my son, my daughter,
exactly.
my children.
And younger men will talk more about childcare.
Absolutely. And they actually feel empowered to talk about it. So it's really, really odd that while most of Europe is moving to much less gendered cabinets and kind of equality broadly between men and women, we're just not making the strides we should be making. It would also, I think, make it a lot more pleasant. I mean, for instance, when that government was being negotiated, I was the only woman at the table. And, you know, from time to time, you just have to put your hand up and say, like, hold on, guys. Like,
I'm always amazed, Nadine, at the number of times I've been in a room over my time in politics where there would be many, many men and a tiny handful of women, and how the men in the room are so unaware of the gendered situation that we're in. It's never ceased to amaze me that, you know, that it's so normal for men that their awareness around the actual disparities is very low sometimes. I sat beside Justin Trudeau one night at a dinner, and Leo was on the other side. And Justin said to Leo, I'm after making my cabinet 50-50. You know, could you do that here? And, you know, Leo then started explaining, we only have X percentage of women in the Dáil, and we have to wait until we have more. And Justin was saying, no, just do it. Just do it. And yeah. There's an interesting point there. Do you wait until you have the 50% of women in the Dáil before you have 50% in cabinet? I don't think so. But of course, you have to have greater numbers of women than we have at present. But it's a very interesting point about, you know, it's kind of chicken and egg. Do you just go for it and just get that diversity? Then more women will run because you begin to see a different sort of politics. So that's interesting. And by the way, talking about care, during COVID, just heard about a piece of research this week that's been done by the Institute, it's called Institute for Gender Equality Studies. They pulled the research together. Women did an extra 36 hours a week of unpaid work during COVID, the equivalent of a full-time job over the course of a year. That's really interesting. And that's a clear statistic coming from research all over Europe, by the way. So I think the whole issue of care and who's doing the caring in our society, I think it's fundamental to women's equality. We've really got to crack it.
Well, you know, you have to have human relations in politics. And if you want equality, you have to have genuine conversations that cut across both genders.
I won't keep you too much longer. I'm very grateful for the time. One thing I did want to know is if there's something you could have told your younger self or a quality that you could have handed out, what would it be?
I think I would say to people, believe in your own abilities, build up your confidence. You know, it takes quite a while. You know, it can be quite difficult. And just believing in your own voice is really important. It takes time, I think. You don't necessarily have it automatically. Some men have it more automatically than some women. I think it's changing with younger women. But just looking back, and it's amazing how often that confidence issue and belief in your own experience and come to the fore with it. That's kind of the area I would say, looking back, that I'd like to see younger women getting that confidence.
What challenges lie ahead for you? What do you want to achieve?
Well, I'm very keen to make sure there's a care strategy in Europe, to do the job I'm in at the moment as an MEP as well as I can. And I've always been that sort of person, you know, whatever ministry I was in. When I was in justice, I did 27 pieces of legislation. As a politician, I've done two referendums that brought the legislation through the Dáil. I mean, I very much enjoy the moment I'm in. I'm not one, really. I never expected to be an MEP. But that opportunity came and I took it and I sort of go with it. So I'm very much for the present rather than, you know, looking ahead to want to do this, that or the other.
Joan, same question to you. What would you like to tell your younger self?
Oh, to just try as hard as you can and do the things you want to do. And if for some reason you're not able to do those, then have a look at other things. And I just think of plenty of life experience, travel, do the things that you feel you want to do and enjoy them.
You know, Nadine, I would say believe in your gut. Believe in your gut.
Well, brilliant advice. Joan Burton and Frances Fitzgerald, thank you so much for your time today on How I Did It.
Pleasure. Thank you, Nadine.
How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast.
Sponsored by Glamdoor, creating space for business to grow.
Now, Joan Burton is staying with us, and I'm delighted to say that I'm joined on the line now by Susan Keogh, communications consultant with Cicero, which is part of the Havas Village in Dublin, and an award-winning broadcaster formerly with Newstalk. Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to speak to you, Nadine. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're joining the podcast today to talk about the art of public speaking. People often have a fear of public speaking, don't they?
Yeah, I think they do. And, you know, I think it's a really kind of natural fear for people. And it's something that is actually a real fear for some people. And it's totally the last thing that they're going to ever want to do. And I suppose for me in my job, it's about helping kind of people to acknowledge that it is really a very small percentage of people who are actually kind of naturally comfortable or feel fully at home, you know, in front of a big audience. Like, most of us don't. That's not most of our, like, it's not our wheelhouse for most of us. Mm-hmm. But what all of us can do is we can all learn to do it if we're sort of willing and able to train ourselves to become more comfortable. And, you know, the result is you're more polished when speaking publicly, whether that's at an event or if it is, you know, when you're engaging with the media. But I was actually at an event earlier in the week, and I was speaking to a man called Kingsley Aikens, who's the CEO of the Networking Institute. And he was talking about something that was really interesting in this regard. And it's in relation to how our networks have totally shrunk because of COVID. So for most people during COVID, your circle was sort of reduced to your family, your close friends, and then the immediate people that you work with. And a lot of those people you were communicating with, you know, virtually. But real opportunity lies outside of those kind of small networks. So now, I guess, we're coming out of COVID and people do want to get back out there with public speaking and engaging with the media. But there's sort of a hesitancy to do it, because it's not because of COVID, but it's because, you know, putting yourself out there in the media and public speaking, all of those things, it involves using a particular muscle. And it's like any muscle. If you haven't used it and you haven't flexed it, you know, it's a weak muscle. And I suppose we've kind of been in that zone for about 2 years. So we're all a little bit out of practice, I think. But there are lots of things that people can do. And I actually feel that maybe COVID has kind of, you know, leveled the playing field in some respects. So I think if there's people listening who are thinking, I need to, you know, get out there and, you know, get the courage to do a bit of public speaking, this is probably a good time to seize the opportunity, I feel.
And what mistakes do people commonly make?
Well, I guess, you know, people I come across, that one of the first mistakes people in leadership or kind of senior roles, the first mistake that they make is that they decide not to engage. So they let that fear that we've just spoken about take over. And, you know, they shy away from kind of opportunities that are there to not only promote themselves, but I suppose promote their business and their brand. And the vast majority of business people that you come across, like, they do know that there is a real importance and, I guess, a real value attached to taking part in events and engaging with the media. But the bad or the disastrous media outings obviously get more airtime than the good ones. So, you know, your natural instinct often is to shy away and think that it's too risky to do that. But I suppose, you know, the bottom line is that media does influence people, whether you like it or not. And I think it's really important for business people to remember that, you know, media influences people whether you engage or not. So I advise people not to shy away, to take the help, take the resources, take the tips, and to put the time in, really, is what it's all about. And you can benefit your business, you can benefit yourself professionally. And I do think, you know, good kind of, you know, whether it's media engagement or public speaking, it can help a business to kind of make that link with their customers and make a personal connection, you know, with their business or with their brand. So it's definitely worth doing. There's values in it, but obviously there's pitfalls there for people.
Are there particular tricks or tips that you have for people who are about to engage in public speaking?
I kind of focus a lot of my training on kind of three P's, which I really do believe in, which would be like to plan, to prepare, and to practice. So on that planning kind of one there first, it's often really the hard part, but it is really truly the foundation on which, you know, either a good media outing or appearance at an event is built out from. So what I'm talking about here is, you know, finding out what is it you're really trying to say, like be crystal clear on your messaging. So, you know, I ask people to think of it as like their mission statement as such. So, you know, make sure you know what it is you're trying to say, but also make sure you've got good people in your corner. So have a trusted kind of person who will play, you know, devil's advocate as such and, you know, pick holes in what you're saying. Because I think what you need to do as a business leader is you need to make sure what makes sense to you makes sense to a wider audience. So if you are going to go and do a bit of public speaking, you're not just probably speaking to the people in your specific industry. It will be a wider audience. But I think it's important that your messaging checks out and that you have it nailed down. And it's that sort of messaging development, I think, is often not really kind of dealt with at the beginning of a company stages. And then it needs to be for everything to come after that. And then, look, we all know preparing is crucial in all walks of life. And as the saying goes, you know, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. And I do really believe in that. And for me, with clients, it extends further than just what it is you're going to say. So I would say to people, you know, where is the event on? How are you getting there? You know, could you go and do a recce? Can you stand on the stage that you're going to stand on? Can you speak into the microphone that you're going to speak into? You know, do you know the audience? Do you know who's going to be there? And I suppose that's about controlling the controllables. So you want to get a person to a point that when they are going to engage in public speaking or in the media, that they only have to be concerned about what's coming out of their mouth and they don't have to actually worry about all the other stuff. And then look, practice, you know, I tell clients, practice in the mirror, practice in the bath, practice in the car. Like, you have to practice. And that's what friends and family are for. Make them listen to your speech, make them hear it and just keep practicing. And I don't necessarily think practice makes perfect, but I do really, really believe that practice makes improvements. So it's definitely worth doing.
Joan, just to bring you in for a moment, public speaking, you're obviously a veteran. Have you got any tips?
Well, first of all, I agree with what Susan said about preparation. That is absolutely the most important thing. And I think you need to ask yourself over and over again, who's the audience? And what is it they've asked you to speak about? Are they really going to pay attention? And then plan it really carefully and try and not break whatever time you've been asked to speak for. Just don't run over the time. I also think as well, unless you're a naturally funny person, keep off the jokes because, you know, and unless you've definitely tested them on both enemies as well as friends, I'd say keep away from jokes unless you're just one of those people who is able to tell a joke. And I think as well, if you're talking about something which includes figures, I would say in a speech, never have more than about three figures because I think the audience is just closed down because they can't keep hold of it. It's not a lecture. I mean, obviously, if you're lecturing, you might be including figures, but that's different. That's in a kind of, you know, people are taking notes perhaps. And I think as well as that, just respect your audience and say, I want people to hear what I have to say, enjoy it, and just go for it. I mean, you do need a bit of courage in public speaking. Everybody, I think, at some stage or other, sweats buckets. Everybody gets nervous. Don't rub your hands together. You know, if it's a podium, make sure you don't knock it down or anything like that by over-clutching the podium. There are all these, you know, Susan would be very familiar with this. People sometimes, it's like building in a little tick. And it's something, if it helps you to have pen and paper, decide stuff like, are you going to take questions from the audience? And if you are, how many? Do you need somebody there who'll actually run the question session for you? So if it's a crowd of hungry journalists, do you have somebody to say, you know, we're going to take five questions or three questions more likely? And that's it. And actually, the journalists will thank you because they don't want to be sitting there 20 minutes later still listening to questions.
Mm. Well, listen, that's great advice from both of you. So I'm guessing the upshot here is feel the fear and do it anyway. Susan, would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And be engaging. As Joan said, it's important to remember, you know, you want to give something of value to the people who have given their time to be there to hear you speak. So try your best to engage that audience as much as possible. But you will get there once you do your preparation.
Susan Keogh, thank you so much. And thank you as well, of course, to Joan Burton.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nadine.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
And my thanks once again to Frances Fitzgerald, Joan Burton and Susan Keogh. Join us next Sunday for the new episode of How I Did It, when we'll be talking tech. I'll be joined by Áine Kerr of Kinsen and Maureen Murray of Tech for Good Dublin. We'll also be discussing the art of CV preparation and job interview techniques with Sarah Geraghty from the Communications Clinic. Remember, you can find all the episodes of How I Did It on the Business Post website, businesspost.ie/podcast. And you can also find us on Spotify, iTunes and other podcast providers. Just search for hashtag How I Did It. The new series of our legal affairs podcast, Law on Trial, is also out now. So why not check that one out too? This episode of How I Did It was co-produced by myself and Catherine Healy. If you'd like to get in touch, you can do so via Twitter, twitter.com/Nadine O'Regan. Or feel free to drop an email, nadine@businesspost.ie. Right, till next time. Thanks for listening. Do take care.
How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast with Nadine O'Regan.
Sponsored by Glandor, creating space for business to grow.